This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Welcome back to the Financial Sense News Hour, which we have been for over a decade and a half. And this is the part of the program which we call The Big Picture. This week, Jim is going to go on the record. And what we do is we summarize many of the emails that we've received from you people, you wonderful listeners out there who want some answers to certain questions. And that's what we do. And we do that periodically as Jim goes on the record. You know, we should have moved that, Jim. Instead of on the record, then it should have become on the CD. Now it should be on the flash drive, you know, because the technology's changing. Okay, first one is from Michael. It has been mentioned on the program that the extra Medicare tax of 0.9% is based on your adjusted gross income. He said it's based on wages.
Well, the actual facts are it's based on wages and self-employment income, and it kicks in at $250,000 for a couple, $200,000 for a single. However, it also applies to active income from general partnership, but if you are a retiree, you get a break. Distributions from retirement accounts and Social Security benefits aren't assessed the surtax. So you are right, Michael. It is based on wages in self-employment income. There are some exceptions as to when it applies.
Okay, number two is from Greg. I've heard Jim and John talking. We're sort of summarizing this. This was a long email. That this is the second most expensive market in history. Is this based on forward earnings? And are the potential tax reform changes reflected in these numbers?
When I talk about the second most expensive market in history, we're looking historically in terms of some of the most overvalued markets that have been followed by severe bear markets. And the most severe bear market was 1929, when PE multiples on stocks got to be very high. And then, of course, it was followed by a bunch of mishaps by government that made the bear market and the recession into a depression. And the other two markets that come into mind was probably the most expensive in stock market history is you would have to go back to the stock market in 1999 and 2000 when we were going through the tech bubble. And then the third is, and it's actually now number two, is the current market that we're in right now. And this is based on a number of measures. Number one, looking at the Case-Shiller 10-year average PE ratio is the highest it's been. Then it's also based on where current PE ratios are in the past. And so whenever you get multiples this high, and you can see this, the higher the PE ratios go on the Dow, the S&P, the more expensive a stock market becomes. The most expensive stock market in history was the stock market in 1999 and 2000 during the tech bubble. But that was sort of an aberration when you take a look at how high multiples got. I mean, some of the valuations that some of these companies got, I don't care if you were looking at Cisco, Microsoft, Intel, even Amazon and some of these technology companies. In fact, there were companies that had high valuations, didn't have any earnings at all. So this is, if you look at standard benchmarks of PE multiples, book value, price to sales, the second highest stock market in history. Now, what could change that? If, for example, the Republicans were to pass tax reform in lower corporate tax rates from 35% to 20 or even 15%, then obviously if a company had a dollar of earnings instead of paying 35 cents in taxes, they would only pay 20 cents or 15 cents in taxes. That could easily bump up the earnings for S&P 500 companies. If, for example, they made them retroactive to, let's say, the beginning of the year, then this stock market would become less expensive. Because, for example, if you had a stock that had earnings of $2 and it was selling at 20 times earnings, but because of taxes or tax savings, the earnings went from $2 to $3, then obviously that stock would be less expensive. The price earnings multiple would come down. So currently the valuations on the market, whether you're looking at the trailing PE ratio or the forward ratio, is clearly the second highest on record. That could change if we got tax reform and they made it retroactive.
Third question today is from Robert. He said, you say to hold dividend stocks in downturns, but here's a scenario. If you're in retirement collecting a dividend on a stock, why be worried about them going down if you're collecting dividends? You said that Coca-Cola did not cut dividends between 2007 and 2008, even though it fell a great amount. So please advise on what would seem to be a contradiction.
It's really not a contradiction, Robert. It depends on the style of investing. For example, the difference between taking a drawdown on a portfolio that's made up of ETFs and mutual funds, which is almost over 90% of most people retired, versus owning individual stocks. And let me give you an example that clarifies that. Let's say, for example, you have $100,000, and let's take two portfolios, $100,000 made up of individual stocks, and $100,000 that is made up of, let's say, ETFs or mutual funds. Now, let's say, to clarify, that you need to take 3% a year out of your portfolio to live on. Well, if you have mutual funds and you're taking out 3% monthly, what are you doing? You are liquidating shares to have that income distributed to you, unless you owned a bond fund. But let's say you own stock funds. Typically, stock funds don't pay 3%. So if you were taking out 3%, you would be liquidating shares during a downturn. The problem is, let's say in the first month, the shares are worth $10. So you liquidate 3% of that. The second month, the shares fall to $9, and you take 3% of that. By the end of the year, let's say the share price falls from $10 down to $7. Now you're liquidating shares at $7. You liquidated shares at $8. You liquidated shares at $9. You're liquidating shares at a lower value. Now let's contrast that to a portfolio of individual stocks. For example, if you own Coca-Cola, it pays a dividend over 3%. So in this case, you're taking your 3% distribution, or maybe more, because Coca-Cola's dividend is higher. You don't have to liquidate Coca-Cola shares. Your 3% income that you are taking from your portfolio is based on the dividends that you are receiving. And the difference here is if your dividends are distributing enough income to you to meet your income requirements, you don't have to liquidate shares versus if you're in a stock mutual fund or stock ETF, in which case you are liquidating shares to meet that distribution. So there's a little bit of clarification there, hopefully, the difference between stock funds and ETFs and owning individual stocks that pay you dividends that meet your distribution. Point number two, what you don't want to do is start out your retirement and go through a huge drawdown. The vast majority of individuals have their investments in ETFs and individual mutual funds. So therefore, if they're starting out their retirement, let's just say you have to take a distribution, a 3 or 4%, what you don't want to do is have a lot of money invested in the stock market at the beginning of your retirement, because if you go through a bear market, as we did between 2007 and 9 and 2000 and 2002, you are liquidating shares every single month to meet your distribution, and you don't want to be doing that when the stock market lost nearly 60% of its value, as it did between 2007 and 2009. So there's a difference between being able to live off the income that is distributed to you. For example, in the two portfolios that I just gave, if I'm sitting on Coca-Cola and I need 3% to live on, and Coke is giving me a dividend of 3.5%, I don't have to liquidate Coke. Yes, Coke went down during the Great Recession. In fact, it lost a third of its value. But during that time, it paid its dividend, and also it increased its dividend. So there's a big difference between individual stocks that pay you out a distribution that is equal to what you need to live on versus liquidating shares to live on, because you don't want to be doing that in a bear market that can last 18 months where the value of those mutual funds can drop as much as 40 and 50%, if not more.
The next one is from Daniel, who used to be a Q-line caller, when, just for people's interest who weren't with us back then, we used to have a 24/7 call-in line where you could record a question for the show and we'd play the question back and then answer it. But Dan would wish we would bring it back because he sees the show as a weather forecast for the market. So he has several questions here. He said they've been building up since he can't leave them on the Q-line. Number one, regarding not giving specific stock tips, it would help to highlight your stock holdings as they can be seen online. It's not necessarily bang up to date right now, but enough to show how you feel about the market. So take that one first.
Well, he's basically talking about something we file every quarter. When you manage over $100 million, you're required with the SEC to file what is called a 13F, which doesn't list everything you own, but basically lists your main holdings and any changes from the previous quarter. So that is online. The other thing, too, I just want to make a point here. I'm really prohibited from law, since I own a brokerage firm as well as a money management firm, from making specific stock recommendations. That isn't allowed. You know, a lot of times we'll have technicians on the program and they may point to a particular stock. Or in the example of Inside the Bubble, which we did a couple of weeks ago, I did examples where I listed companies that were in the index, or I might use a company, for example, Coca-Cola, or as we did with the Fab Five versus the Dogs of the Dow. But you notice what I'm doing is I'm making an illustration of a point. I'm not making an individual recommendation, which I'm not allowed to do.
Which people do you like to follow on CNBC or Bloomberg? And I would guess he'd probably ask Fox Business in here.
You know, I really don't follow anybody in particular. You know, I do keep sometimes Bloomberg Television or Fox Business on just to see what the media is covering or what the topic du jour is of the day. But I really try not to pay too much attention to the financial media because I really don't want to get influenced by that. I use it more as a indicator. When the media is focused obsessively on a particular issue, it's usually going to turn out to be just the opposite. So I use the media more as a contrary indicator than anything else. So Dan, I really don't follow anybody in particular.
Years ago, you had strong feelings on the subject of peak oil. Indeed, we talked about that a lot, Jim. We felt that at the time we were heading towards a real crisis by the middle of the teens. But now here we are in the middle of the teens and we have fracking. So does peak oil still apply, or how do we now have too much oil going into the future?
Well, obviously, right now we have too much oil. And one thing I didn't foresee was the effects of horizontal drilling, fracking, and shale oil, which has been a game changer. I mean, it's basically changed the rules of the oil market and made OPEC less effective. In fact, one of the largest producers can be the U.S. Will we have peak oil eventually? I still believe that, but I think it's been put off into the distant future because it's not just shale oil here. They can find shale elsewhere, and they're also going to start drilling for oil. Now, it'll take higher prices in the Arctic. And also, as a result of technology, we keep bringing down the cost of finding and producing oil. I mean, when the shale revolution hit, it was said that, you know, shale producers needed $60 to $70 a barrel of oil. If you look at it today, shale producers can make money even in the mid 40s, and some are making money even in the 30s. It's really, it gets down to the marginal cost of oil. But a lot of the technology that has come about, I didn't see, as did others. And so, you know, our feeling about peak oil coming mid-decade was obviously wrong.
And your ideas about gold bugs, they've been telling people to buy precious metals, but for the last 5 years, when gold has gone down steadily for the last 5 years since 2011. So your particular thoughts on that?
The problem, I think, with gold bugs, it becomes more of a religion than it does investing. And so when prices of or drivers of gold go away, as they did at the end of 2011, and gold and silver were in a bubble, they don't see it. And so the problem is they're always looking for gloom and doom, and they're always talking and predicting disasters. You can see them. All you have to do is turn on cable news and watch the commercials, and they're predicting the end of everything, disaster and, you know, incredible prices. The problem is, if you take a look at gold in the last decade, the drivers were economic growth and prosperity in the emerging world, which created more demand. It wasn't any gloom and doom thing that brought about the price of gold in its rise. For example, it was economic growth. It was the emerging world. Just as in the 70s, it was really an inflationary world that drove the price of gold along with other assets.
Any favorite books for 2016 or 2017?
There's a number of books I've read. I try to read a book every week. Some of my favorites were, The 5 Rules for Successful Stock Investing by Pat Dorsey from Morningstar. That's a favorite. The Most Important Thing by Howard Marks, one of the head strategists at Oakmark Capital, are probably two of my favorites. And what I'm looking forward to that's coming out, I think it's in the month of June or July, by Henry Kaufman. Actually, the book's out. And another one, which I am currently reading, it's called Tectonic Shifts in Financial Markets, People, Policies, and Institutions by Henry Kaufman. He used to be the original Dr. Doom on Wall Street, and it's a fascinating book, and that's my current reading.
Bob has two questions. Number one, I feel like there's a recession coming soon. Well, you're not alone, Bob. End of year or so, especially since this expansion seems to be long in the tooth. What kind of changes would you make in preparation for it, and how far in advance of the LEIs rolling over?
Well, a couple things. You're never going to know when you finally hit a market top or what kind of event can trigger it. We do know that when the LEI start to roll over, the likelihood of a recession becomes more probable. Now, sometimes the LEIs can give a false reading. And the best example I can give you is in the summer of 2011, we had a number of events hit. We had Fukushima. We had a spike in oil prices to $110 a barrel with the Arab Spring. We had the debt ceiling debate. We also had the pig crisis with sovereign debt in Europe. All of those things showed the LEIs rolling over into recession territory. Our recession indicator was up. So what we did, as these things began to happen and as the LEIs began to roll over, we increased our cash position in that year. We've done something as well. Going to the fourth quarter of last year, we have reduced our stock holdings. In other words, we're no longer 100% invested in stocks. Our cash and bond positions now represent about 30% to 40% of portfolios, depending on the client objective. So what you try to do is the market gets to new higher record levels as PE multiples expand, as the market gets more expensive. What you start doing is just exercising risk control and taking some chips off the table and getting a little bit more defensive, which is what we're doing now. Now, when is this recession coming? Could it be the end of this year? Could it be next year? You know, a lot of it is going to depend on how aggressive the Fed gets, because what we know from history is every recession and bear market has been preceded by Fed rate hikes. So what do we know now? The Fed is in a rate raising mode, and they will continue to do so until eventually they break the economy. So you already have a heads up. You know the market is expensive. Number two, the economy has been weak recently. And number three, you know the Fed is going to continue to raise interest rates. So all of those should give you a bit of caution. As to exact timing, I don't believe anybody's smart enough, including ourselves, to time the exact top. I don't think that's possible. What you can do is when you see this, let's say, you know, like a good sailor, when you see the barometer dropping and you see storm clouds on the horizon, you start, depowering the sailboat and you start heading for safe harbors. And right now, what we do know is the economy is still growing. Corporations are still earning money. We do have possible stimulus in the pipeline, whether it gets passed this year or next, I don't know. But we do know the market's expensive, the Fed is raising interest rates, and we know what those two eventually lead to.
And Jim, he had a capital gains question on an advisor. When it comes to engaging a financial advisor, how should capital gains be minimized so that the advisor can take over?
Well, the first thing you're going to have to do when you engage an advisor is you're going to have to, you know, obviously that advisor is going to look at your portfolio, and the two of you should discuss the consequences of that portfolio, whether what you're owning fits with, let's say, where the advisor is placing their investments. So, for example, if you had individual stocks and some of those stocks were good value stocks, you should be discussing that with your advisor, and the advisor should be discussing with you and saying, you know what, there are a couple things in your portfolio we would want to trim back on, or there are a couple things that in your portfolio we don't like. What you don't want is an advisor that basically says, okay, we're liquidating everything. That really isn't the sign of a good advisor. What you should do is discuss this in advance so both parties know what's going to be done, and then that way you can figure out, say, for example, you had 10 stocks. Your new advisor says, there's three of these I'd like to trim or get rid of. Then you know exactly what the capital gains are. But it should be a discussion between both you and your advisor, with both of you agreeing as to what should be done.
With your dogs of the Dow, it's obviously more than a coincidence that it starts with the beginning of the year. But here in Australia, our fiscal year begins in July. So would it be better? Basically, what he's asking here is to use the same strategy, but to use it in July instead of in January.
You know, most people judge their returns on an annual basis. So if you take the beginning of the year, how much did you make at the end of the year? I think it's more important to be consistent. I prefer the calendar year. I mean, I suppose you could probably do it July 1st, but I think you'd be better off starting out in January in consistent, because really what you're trying to judge or benchmark against, how did I do against the markets on a calendar year? So if you started in July, you would have to get a rate of return that's a little bit different. You would have to price what the stock market did from July of this year to July of the following year. I think you're better off starting out at the beginning of the year on January. That way you can track all the indexes and be on the same calendar points.
Okay, Jim from Doug. Listening to many of your shows, I follow with interest the LEI discussions, interest rates, money flow, etc. Reading material on my brokerage website over the weekend, you're talking about the business cycle investing with respect to sectors. My 401k plan has us investing more respect to capitalization, large and small. I was thinking it would be interesting if you could cover differences in investing by capitalization and get into growth versus value investing.
You know, there's a couple of things, and I would probably say the best thing to do is listen to what we're talking about the economy and LEIs. If the economy is doing well, you're going to see probably your large cap stocks do well. Also, your small cap stocks. When the LEIs start to roll over, when things become riskier, money begins to gravitate into fewer and fewer areas of the market. It tends to gravitate towards what we call the generals, or the large cap stocks represented in the S&P and the Dow stocks. So investing by capitalization, that's really a sector call, a timing call, and we try not to avoid that. What we try to do is tell you what's going on in the market, what sectors are moving the market. Like, for example, last week, we talked out of the nine sectors in the S&P, there are only two that are doing well right now, which is consumer discretionary and technology. We also talked about the major indexes are going sideways, except for the NASDAQ, which is one of the few indexes that is hitting new records, while others. And then we also talk about how the foreign markets are starting to outperform U.S. markets. When you get into growth and value, they perform differently depending on what's going on in the market. When the economy is slowing down, then growth tends to outperform because the economy is not growing very well. That means earnings are slowing down. So investors gravitate more towards growth stocks. When everything is going well, the shift goes in the opposite direction and goes into value. So what we try not to do here, Doug, is become a market timing. What we try to do is give you general trends that are going on in the market and the economy to tell you when risk is elevated versus when risk has decreased. And right now, we have an elevation of risk on the basis of two things. Number one, the VIX has been in a low area in the 10-11 area, which usually indicates complacency. And the other thing has been credit spreads between high quality debt like sovereigns and corporate debt has narrowed considerably. So investors are not getting compensated for taking additional risk. Usually when those two elements are present, it usually tells you you're either close to a correction of some sort and the market has got overpriced.
From Bill, he says, please explain why the Federal Reserve has to contract or reduce its balance sheet. It seems it could actually expand it to infinity. So why would they do that?
It's simply another form of tightening what the Fed is doing. And sometimes you'll hear the Fed officials saying, hey, the market's getting a little crazy. The Fed reacts, whether they want to admit it or not, to what's going on in the market. For example, I think one of the reasons they raised interest rates in March following a rate hike in December is the stock market was booming. I guarantee you, if the stock market was falling off a cliff like it was in the first couple months of 2016, you wouldn't have seen another Fed rate hike. And that's why they withheld, especially with all the turmoil that we had in the markets. But when the Fed reduces its balance sheet, it's another form of tightening. I think the figure is for like every $500 billion that they reduce their balance sheet, it's the equivalent of a 1 percentage point increase in the Fed funds rate. So it's simply another form of tightening. What the Fed is doing is withdrawing liquidity from the markets, and their basis for doing this is they think the markets are getting overheated and valuations are very high. And the Fed is very well aware, although they've never been able to do this successfully, that when stock markets get overheated and they get into bubble-like territory, as they did in 2007 and they did in 2000, then it inevitably leads to a crash. And so what they try to do is cool the markets down. This would be one other form of doing so.
We have an email here from D. I don't know if that's from Dan, David, doggone it.
Donette,
yeah, right. All the D words here.
Dalio?
I guess so.
Well, I don't know.
Many people have their entire retirement plans in 401ks, and by law, they're limited to mutual funds and bond funds. They can't invest in private equity and hedge funds. So will those of us who aren't affluent enough for family offices be left feeding on the crumbs or second-rate equities?
No, not at all. In fact, hedge funds have not done that well, and they charge a lot of money. And their performance has been miserable. Same thing with some of these private equity funds. And usually these kind of funds do very poorly in a down market. A lot of hedge funds blew up between 2007 and 2009 and lost their investors' money. And private equity tends to peak towards a market cycle. So, you know, most 401k plans today, at least the ones that I see, have a large array of options for investors, from small cap to mid cap, short-term bond funds, long-term bond funds, sovereign, corporate, high-yield bond funds, international funds, large cap, small cap. So, I mean, you pretty much are left with a wide array of options. So I wouldn't say that you're limited in any sense. And not being able to go into hedge funds might not be a bad thing.
Frank writes, Jim has frequently discussed the Fed's proposed reduction in balance sheet. One aspect of this that doesn't seem to come up is how this could affect the budget deficit. The Federal Reserve collects interest on its holdings, which it uses to pay its expenses. The interest left over is returned to the Treasury. So this is no small thing, and recently they gave the Treasury $100 billion. So if they reduce holdings, what would be the consequences?
Well, you would see three consequences. And actually, I'm trying to think, John, we did a show on this, the consequences of the Fed reducing its balance sheet. Number one, it would force the Treasury to issue more debt. And the more debt that's out there, that could eventually drive interest rates up, because the Fed, instead of reinvesting the bonds that come due, I think there's like 400 something billion this year and almost half a trillion next year. That's 400 billion that doesn't get reinvested should they decide to shrink their balance sheet, which means that's just 400 billion that the Treasury would have to raise in the open market. So number one, it forces the Treasury to issue more debt because the Fed is not buying it directly. Number two, it's going to drive up interest rates. It's like anything in supply and demand. The more bonds you put out there than there is demand, it drives the price up. In this case, interest rates. Number three, it is going to drive up the deficit, because that $100 billion that you referred to, and that was actually 2015 when they gave $100 billion. In 2016, I think the figure had been reduced to $90 billion. That means less money that is remitted to Congress, which means a bigger budget deficit.
This next question is an interesting one from Michael. He said, Jim often talks about inflation affecting people, but it feels to me inflation is non-existent. We're actually in deflation is what it seems like. Some prices go up, some go down, depending on what it is you're buying. Three areas of inflation: higher education, medical costs, and housing. We already put our kids through college. We use little medical services, and we've paid off our home. So how does inflation affect us? At the grocery store, we buy at Costco to save money by buying in bulk. Yeah, so do we. And the energy area, we're considering solar. I've known several people, Jim, who have done this. Basically, new technology and more competition. I just don't see inflation.
Well, it depends on what you're measuring, Michael, because you may have put your kids through school, so you're not affected by education expenses. Your house is paid off, but you do have, and your medical cost, you made reference that you don't use it. I can guarantee you, the older you get, you will be subject to severe medical costs. It's probably the biggest inflation aspect of anybody's retirement, with the average couple in retirement spending almost $250,000 out of pocket. So I can tell you, as you get older, you will be subject to inflation. There's other things, for example, that aren't measured in inflation. For example, here in my own state of California, they just increased the cost at the grocery store. They charge us 10 to 15 cents for a bag to bag our groceries in the name of global warming. They just increase a pack of cigarettes by $2 from 87 cent tax to $2.87. They're increasing our cable bill tax. They're increasing our utilities. So it really depends on what you measure. Here in California, which promotes, let's say, green energy, they encourage people to get hybrids and electric cars. And what did California do this year? They're slapping on a new additional $100 fee for people that drive electric cars or hybrids, because we aren't paying much in gas taxes. I drive a hybrid instead of filling my car up once a week like I used to. I only buy one tank of gas a week. So what does California do? They're going to charge me an extra $100 because I am not spending as much money on gas. So it really depends on what you measure inflation. But I can tell you, if you are retired, I would seriously start putting aside some money for medical inflation, because it is going to hit you. It hits retirees more than anything else, and probably become one of the second highest aspects of your budget throughout your retirement years.
And, you know, one of the areas, Jim, that I noticed it recently, and it really struck me, I was talking to one of the vendors at the supermarket. Go look at the chips aisle, you know, where you have Doritos and taco chips and my favorite big giant sourdough pretzels. A couple of months ago, everything went, and they went down by a third. If you look at candy bars and everything else like that, the manufacturers are giving you less for the same price. So it looks like the old candy bar, the Hershey bar you used to buy, or the Three Musketeers. It isn't. You're getting less for it. And that's the way they're compensating for it. But I consider that an unusual indicator of inflation, because it's clear across the board that this is happening at the supermarket.
Oh, you can see it in the size of a package of cheese. You can see it in the size of a package of cereal. And you can see it in whether you're looking at chips or, you know, everything just gets a little smaller. And you can see it also in candy bars. One of the things we love to get for our grandchildren is they love these little Haagen-Dazs bars. Oh, my goodness, John, if you take a look at the Haagen-Dazs bar you get today and compare that to what you got 5 years ago, the one good news is there's fewer calories. But the reason is they're smaller in size. Yeah,
so you're paying more for less calories. So now, wait a minute. Does this mean if I go out and spend a lot of money on food, I lose weight? Is that the idea? I'm trying to figure out where you're going. Okay.
Yeah, because you're spending the same money, but you're getting fewer calories because you're eating less food.
So the more money I spend at the supermarket, the more weight I lose. Is that how this works?
Yeah. It's the new diet plan by manufacturers. You spend more money, but you get fewer calories.
I think you're pulling my leg. Anyway, that's it for Jim Going on the Record and for the Big Picture today. What's coming up in the weeks ahead? I haven't even looked. I'm sure you have.
You know, they're saying they're still working through these bills through Congress, so it's going to be interesting because we know that, for example, by the month of August, Congress goes on recess. So the question is, what bills will be in the hopper that will be through the committee? And I'm thinking of the repeal of Obamacare, the president's tax plan, both corporations and individuals, and then infrastructure. They keep talking about it, John, but we don't see anything. We seem to be caught up with the latest false narrative on, you know, the scandal du jour, which the media seems to over-focus on and blow out of proportion. So other than that, I would say probably the next thing we're going to be focusing on, what happens next month in the month of June, the Fed will meet, and the futures market is widely anticipating the Fed will raise the Fed funds rate 0.25 point, and we will go from 1 to 1.25%. So it'll be interesting to see what happens with the economic numbers and what the Fed says accompanying this meeting, because the next likely rate hike will be in December. At least right now, that's the way the futures market is pricing things. And also, we'll have to, we'll be coming to the end of corporate earnings for the second quarter. So we'll want to see if the earnings that took place in the first quarter are followed through in the second quarter. But I would say probably the next big event is, what is the Fed going to do, assuming there's no other geopolitical event that interferes with that, because the last Fed meeting was basically a yawn. So all of that will be coming up in the weeks ahead. We'll be here to talk about it. In the meantime, on behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. And a special thanks, by the way, to all our emails that came in that allowed us to do our on the record today, some great questions that came in. We want to say thanks to all of you that sent us your emails. We appreciate it. But in the meantime, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense News Hour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.